In yet another futile and hostile move, the European Union, following the footsteps of the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., have announced new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in a show of support for rioters over alleged human rights violations. Does the European Union, representing countries in the 27-member bloc, have a footing to stand on when it comes to human rights? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards at play and how this will impact the relationship between the EU and the Islamic Republic. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Batul Subeiti joins us. She's a political analyst who joins us from London. Also joining us is Sayed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Batul Subeiti. We are looking at the EU to have imposed sanctions on Iran over what they have called human rights abuses, which is alleged. They have, one segment of it has been on Iranian police and security sectors who have been working so hard to try to protect people, try to protect property, etc. And this is viewed, in one sense, if you agree, as a way to undermine the country's police and security apparatus who have been standing up to the rioters. Do you agree with that? And what do you view? What's your reaction to the EU sanctions in the first place?
Right. Yeah. So, of course, as we all know, Mahsa's tragic death sparked those widespread protests. And, you know, thousands did take to different streets demanding answers and justice for Mahsa, which is something expected. It shows that the Iranian nation is energetic and won't tolerate potential injustice. But, of course, it's also no surprise that the mobilizations turned very quickly violent. You had armed separatist groups that clashed with security forces. And as you mentioned, the security forces did what any government force is expected to do in that situation. That's to clamp down on rioters, who, of course, began to pull off the headscarves of Muslim women, setting public properties on fire. So the way that the protests morphed could never in any way, shape or form be characterized as peaceful by the slightest. It wasn't normal. And not because of the way that the security forces dealt with it, but because of the rioters. I mean, it was led by foreign trained spies. And there's a lot of evidence of this. You know, the attacks on Iranian security forces, it enabled terrorists to come out. You know, one of them was the anti-Iran terrorist Kamala group. Iranian intelligence sources also released information about how groups who are affiliated with Al-Qaeda were actually killed by the Iranian military forces in provinces like Sistan and Balochistan after they claimed responsibility for deadly attacks on police stations that killed four IRGC members. You know, the IRGC even dismantled arms trafficking gangs in places like Western Azerbaijan. So, you know, it's no secret that the West had pre-planned this. You know, whether they were going to use the title of Mahsa's death or any other title, they unleashed their undercover collaborator networks to wreak havoc in order to exert pressure on Iran in this very, very sensitive period where the nuclear negotiations are ongoing. And the West does this from time to time. It hijacks Iranian people's demands. Uh-huh. And this protest was certainly not even as large as 2019's and certainly shouldn't even compare to the scope in 2009. But in terms of the second part of your question on Europe, the sanctions that they had put, we see how Europe is actually just following the traces of America. And it does this, you know, it does this against its very own interests. So even if I give the example of confronting Russia via Ukraine.
What is their interest? You know, what is their gain here by doing this?
Right. So there is a trajectory of Europe following America when it comes to these things. I mean, I was giving the example now of even when it comes to confronting Russia via Ukraine, the European stance against Russia has actually harmed Europe. So it's not even a case of what do they gain out of
okay.
it. They're actually harming their interests by following this
gotcha.
American trajectory in a very blind fashion.
Very well. So, you know, it's interesting, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, what our guest there Betul Saveti said. Because tell us the thought process as you see it when you take a look at the EU and you have certain events, incidents that are tragic in a country, which every country experiences, such as Iran, and they pick this one out. They don't listen to what Iran has provided in terms of the cause of death, and they are disregarding in the sanctions that they've imposed some of the great examples that are, I guess, they're cited about these outside groups like the Kamala that she didn't mention, but you know, these are foreign-backed terrorist groups. All those are not mentioned. The killing of IRGC members, that's not mentioned. And yet they come out, they impose these sanctions, and they are portraying the Islamic Republic as a negative force in all of this. So give us your take on the whole thing.
Well, it's fundamentally a soft power war, which Europe is complicit in. It always has been. It's hidden behind, of course, the Anglo-Zionist empires, you know, coattails. But the reality is that it is part and parcel of that. And now even more so, if we're thinking of the Europeans of having some sort of independent foreign policy, I think you can forget it, because now that they've been cornered into literally being on the front line of a war with Russia, you're going to see even less and less of an EU neutrality, as it were. And what you're seeing here is really just a manifestation of the ongoing hypocrisy of Europe and its general kind of attitude towards Iran. There is an Iranophobia. There is an Islamophobia, which is locked in systemically to European foreign policies. It's locked in systemically to their domestic policies. And the hypocrisy becomes even more apparent about what they're doing with Iran in terms of being so judgmental. And as Betul said very rightly, that they were part of an organized, orchestrated, deep state, systematic effort to change the regime, or change the government, as they'd call it, regime. Of course, that hypocrisy is exposed by the fact that Islamophobia and the attacks on Iranian property here in Europe have been pretty much allowed. I mean, there's been very little police response or protection offered for the Islamic Center of England here in London, which was attacked. We know that people have been attacked in Hamburg. There are all sorts of clear and obvious examples of Iranian MKO operatives being given a free hand, a free rein, really, to do as they like. So you can see that the hypocrisy there is there. Of course, the other hypocrisy is that Europe has a track record of stamping down very, very hard on peaceful protesters. I mean, the Yellow Jackets, for one, an example in France, where you can go and pick any number of incidents you like where the actual really militaristic French police stamped down very hard when it was necessary for them to do so. The Banlieue riots in Paris are another example. Tens of thousands of people who were marching in Belgium's capital, for instance, and in the Netherlands, and even Austria, Croatia. We've seen during the COVID-19 sure. response, when people did object, again, there was a huge stamping down and a massive a police state, if you like, draconian putting down of any opposition to the standard establishment government line. So it reeks of a hypocrisy. The Western and the European particular okay. response is totally hypocritical.
Well, you were talking about, Betul Saveti, about the these groups that are foreign-backed, that are getting their funds and inciting acts of violence and participating in it. Now, based on what we have been provided, the EU has intentionally actually disregarded and dismissed documents that were offered by Iran. And I'm guessing that that's even as an act of goodwill, Iran providing these documents to prove foreign support for the riots. Why is the EU, do you think, then disregarding it if Iran is providing proof of it?
Right. This whole orchestrated campaign against Iran is in order to apply sanctions in the first place. So someone might ask, why sanctions now? The main aim of the sanctions now is to increase the instability and to provide the ammunition also for the rioters. I mean, even if that's on the level of providing internet, for example, you know, Elon Musk spoke about, you know, Starlink. You have tech firms that are relieving sanctions on access to apps like Zoom, for example. It begs the question of, oh, why now this is happening? It's to sustain the riots. Now, the sanctions are an So basically, the riots are an excuse for the sanctions, but these sanctions are a means to an end. It's a means to pressure Iran to comply with American demands. They want a nuclear deal, but they still want sanctions on Iran. They want to have their cake and eat it. Specifically now, the US is looking to change its strategy of dealing with Iran. Since they haven't been successful through negotiations, Iran wants sanction relief. It wants robust guarantees. It wants verification. Nothing outside of the scope of the previous deal, since Iran has always been compliant, but it wants reassurances, and it has every right. And the US haven't been able to pressure Iran or to convince Iran to forego its demands when it comes to sanctions relief, verification, sequencing. And Iran has had the upper hand in the negotiations. The nuclear bar negotiations have been on a stumble block because Iran is not in a hurry to get it signed. It wants to gain the maximum out of it. So to wreak havoc internally, to get riots on the streets, is to pressure Iran. It's to use this protest movement to ask for more sanctions in hopes of even potentially sustaining its and hastening its conclusion, or to get Iran to compromise on its rights.
Sure.
Not realizing that they're actually shooting themselves in the foot and further demonstrating their lack of goodwill and intention. The whole point over here is we will discuss the US because Europe is really just an extension of US foreign policy.
I see. Okay. Well, it's interesting that you call it a protest movement. Say, Mohsen Abbas, when you take a look at whoever is out there that is rioting and breaking the law, which includes vandalism, which includes more so, not so much vandalism, but destruction of property. We're looking at these groups that are very clear in what they're chanting and what they want. And basically, they want a change in the governance of the Islamic Republic to whomever or whatever is not clear. Given that, which is clear in their chants, the EU is still supporting that, if you want to call it a movement, or those people, or those groups. Isn't that clear interference in another country's affairs?
It absolutely is a clear interference, but when have they ever not interfered in other states who are not complying with the overall, if you like, international order, as they will say? The international order, by that, they mean their masters. The masters are the money mafias that control the banking fraternity of London, Wall Street, and beyond. So Iran remains the only real state which is not within the Bank of International Settlements, isn't complying to the world order in a full and final way, and is resisting on so many levels, on a regional level, and is resisting not only militarily, but is also capable of now resisting with cyber technology. And you notice that they have actually started sanctioning the cyber efforts or the cyber capability of Iran. This is specifically because they fear Iran's capability of not only on a military level, which it's proved time and time again on the ground, but they're also now going to fear that Iran will recognize that it needs a really powerful soft power response. You need an equally powerful way of being able to resist the propaganda, the deep state kind of psychological operations, the rollout of all of these kind of color revolution efforts. There needs to be a much stronger content and substance, which will help to educate not only the Islamic Republic of Iran and its own population, but also the world at large, because we're now living in a world where huge changes during this great reset, which Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum and others are pushing. Now, Iran is not totally part of that. And one of the examples I'll give is that Ayatollah Khamenei very wisely resisted the Agenda 2030, for instance, the UN Sustainable Goals role. Now, that's just couched language for depopulation, for LGBT agendas, for more hedonism, more liberalism, and more control of the agricultures and the industries of the so-called poorer nations. Now, Iran has very strongly resisted that, and I think that these things all make sure that Iran is enemy number one. So Iranophobia is not an accident. It's something that's whipped up, whether it's Netanyahu when he was showing his little childish graphs about why they should bomb Iran's nuclear plants, or whether it's Donald Trump trying to assassinate a diplomatic mission with Haji Qasem Soleimani. All of these actions are basically desperation desperation. Their desperation of the money mafia, their desperation of Israel, which is their favorite pet in the world, and specifically in West Asia. And the Europeans are basically a paper tiger that wags. It's a tail. It wags every time the Atlantic, if you like, real powers, the Americans and the Zionists that control them, actually tell them to jump. Look, for instance, German exports to the U.S. are worth $110 billion per month. That's one quote I've had in 2017. I mean, it sold $3 billion to Iran at that time. So you can see there was a no-brainer in terms of Europe going the way of the Americans and doing as they're told. And now that the Russians are squeezing the energy aspect of it and of their lifeline, you can see that all of these nations will fall even more in line with the Americans. And they're not going to let up in terms of trying to see a JCPOA or a nuclear agreement which really works in the long run. And Iran has already started shifting his attention very rapidly to China, Russia, and the Eurasian axis with the Shanghai Cooperation, etc., and very rightly so.
Yeah, we only have 5 minutes left. So many angles to cover over here. I got to squeeze this one in between what both have said. It's kind of not along those lines, but again, it gives another dimension to this. And I'd like to ask you, Tal Sobeiti, about how the EU has insisted that Iran has been involved in the Ukraine conflict by sending military equipment to Russia. Now, this has come despite frequent denials, again, in relation to the sanctions that have been leveled against Iran by the EU. Now, the quick question that comes about is why would they do that when they themselves have provided countries like France, the UK, and Germany, for example, have provided weapons to Saudi Arabia when it comes to the war on Yemen, which has killed so many innocent civilians?
Right, exactly. So the whole, I guess, this whole war that is being launched is really just one of consolidating American hegemony. America is threatened by the unipolar nature of the world in which it is dominating, but it actually doesn't realize how this whole campaign against Russia, against China, against Iran is very, very counterproductive for the West, because the opposing camp that is actually bearing the brunt of Western hegemony and sanctions is forming stronger alliances. You know, the US is increasing the list of countries that they are opposed to, and these entities are getting stronger, and they will seek to break the hegemony of the dollar through building those parallel systems and those parallel alliances, whether it's the Shanghai Cooperation Council, the Shanghai Cooperation, whether it's BRICS, and this new world order is being formed, including Russia, China, Iran, that are key players. It is a multipolar world and will therefore balance out the American fist. I think by now the hypocrisy is clear for everyone to see, right? And the decision that Russia took has to be seen.
How do you deliver that message? As you said, the hypocrisy that is evident to see. How do you deliver that message across the world?
I mean, the hypocrisy is clear on every single level. I mean, the biggest form of tyranny is the propaganda machine. You know, if the West truly cares about freedom, for example, those 275 million tweets that we saw about Mahsa Amini would be against Western sanctions that killed thousands of vulnerable women and children. We would see those 275 million tweets, for example, against the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia that doesn't even have elections, and it's only enabled to carry out crimes of the highest order due to the protection that it receives from the West as its client state. We would see record-breaking tweets, for example, for the Muslim women that are forced to unveil in supposed enlightened secular societies like France,
indeed,
you know, that are supposed to protect religious freedoms, let alone singling out Muslim targets.
So why doesn't that happen, say, Mohsen Abbas, when it comes to Palestinians, for example? Why does the EU, first of all, come out, and it's supposed to be part of the Mideast Quartet, come to think of it, but they only come out and condemn. But why isn't there a massive tweet storm against what Israel is doing against Palestinians?
Because all of these social media sites, most of the Western media outlets, whether they're television, social media, Twitter, Facebook, name them all, whichever one you want to turn to, ultimately the hand and the finance and the people that control it in the background are all part of one very powerful neoliberal, neoconservative ideology. And what they've done, what they're doing today is not something that's happened overnight. This is something that they planned at the turn of the century. They said very clearly the American military was going to knock out seven nations. Out of that, they pretty much done it to everybody except Iran and Venezuela. I think they're the only ones left out of that system. So you're faced with a pre-planned, premeditated, absolutely calculated attack by the most powerful forces in this world, and they have an ideological problem with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Let's not forget that. Imam Khomeini set up an establishment here which has some moral values, and it has a dream. It has an Islamic dream. Whether it's being able to achieve it, absolutely not. They're certainly not allowing it to achieve that dream in the way that perhaps he would have envisaged. But nonetheless, that war, that ideological war, is real, it's existential. You see, once you have an ideology like neoliberalism, which wants narcissism, which wants hedonism, which wants to promote all of this kind of slavery of a new kind to the world, you have to have a thinking, an ideology, a kind of a dream which opposes that. The Islamic dream that Iran has been given. At the heart of it, Imam Khamenei has fully embraced that.
Right.
And I hear it in all of his speeches. He's very smart, big wise, okay. Knows exactly what he's saying. And he is consciously opposing that
sure.
Hedonism, that kind of very, very evil kind of ideology that's coming from these forces.
Okay, final question about Tulsabedi. I told you time is running out quickly, so I give you a minute on this. Is what kind of response should Iran give, which is proportionate and reciprocal when it comes to the EU sanctions, and how do you think that response should be given?
Right. So I think sanctions on entities and individuals in Iran have existed for 40 years. It doesn't affect Iran at this point. Iran has managed to create a resistance economy out of it on every single level, from manufacturing to agriculture to scientific growth. Sanctions have actually backfired. So in a way, when Europe sanctions Iran, Iran turns those problems into opportunities, and it figures out a way that it can actually grow itself out of it. So it's not expected that these sanctions from the Europeans would affect Iran. What I would say is these sanctions are actually affecting relations, because it shows Europe is unreliable. It shows that they don't stick to their pledges. So it's actually harming Europe's reputation and Europe's stance more than it can ever harm Iran.
Thank you so much, Betul Sabedi, political analyst. Said Mohsen Abbas, a pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavli, it's goodbye until the next Spotlight.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قالوا نعبد أصناما فنظل لها عاكفين
They said, we worship idols and remain to them devoted.
قال هل يسمعونكم إذ تدعون
He said, do they hear you when you supplicate?
أَوْ يَنْفَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَضُرُّونَ
Or do they benefit you? Or do they harm?
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 72nd verse of chapter Shu'ara. قَالَ هَلْ يَسْمَعُونَكُمْ إِذْ تَدْعُونَ The 73rd one as well. أَوْ يَنْفَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَضُرُّونَ Said Prophet Abraham, do they hear you when you call? Or do they profit you or harm you? As you may have been previously with us, dear listeners, the Holy Quran in its 26th chapter, chapter Shu'ara, starts consoling his prophet more by mentioning the story of Prophet Abraham and his invitation of the pagans to monotheism. So when he started his invitation, he first referred to his close ones, his kinship, and he started asking them questions. مَا تَعْبُدُ In answer to that, they said, we worship idols and we are ever devoted unto them. This fact means that all human beings are in true need of worship. If you guide them, if you show them the right path and where they should point this worship to, they will be guided. They will be reaching salvation. But if you do not introduce the true God, if they do not find the true God, the absolute cause of the universe, they will resort to some other things to worship. In this case, the statues made of gold and silver and wood and other things. And they worshipped it, and they considered it a symbol of their venerable and sacred things. Anyway, Prophet Abraham responds their answer with a question. قَالَ هَلْ يَسْمَعُونَكُمْ إِذْ تَدْعُونَ These things you worship, do they hear you when you call them? أَوْ يَنْفَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَضُرُّونَ Or do they profit you or harm you when you worship them, when you talk to them? Is that beneficial for you? Is that harmful for you? Do they do anything at all? The first step of the invitation is that you start with logical arguments. Prophet Abraham did this. He started with logic. هَلْ يَسْمَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَنْفَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَضُرُّونَ This is a very logical argument. The thing you are worshipping must be giving you some benefits, or must be repelling some damage and harm from you. If it's no use for you to worship, then what kind of a symbol is this? So, in this method of propagation as well, we see that Prophet Abraham is awakening the consciences more by asking questions, because man by nature is worshipper, and if he does not adorn the right, he tends to wrong. Prophet Abraham is trying to introduce to them what they should be worshipping.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد الجواد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, continuing the story of Prophet Abraham, the Holy Quran is referring to some matters of history, and it does not refer to the number, name, or time of the event. But it is stating the instructive points and contents and message of the story. So, Prophet Abraham started with the most important evil they were committing, which was associating something with Allah. And Prophet Abraham started with logic and reasoning as the first step of the propagation. He used some clear and understandable reasonings confronting those ordinary people. This Prophet Abraham could have used some more complicated words and phrases, but this is the most simple form of reasoning. هل يسمعونكم أو ينفعونكم أو يضرون? Do they hear you? Do they profit you? Do they harm you? This is the easiest way possible to remind someone to awaken the consciences of the people by asking questions. Anyway, Prophet Abraham, using these two verses, heard their words and protested them. He condemned them by means of two severe logical sentences. قَالَ هَلْ يَسْمَعُونَكُمْ إِذْ تَدْعُونَ? Do they hear you when you call them? And he continued, أَوْ يَنْفَعُونَكُمْ أَوْ يَضُرُّونَ? Or do they profit you or harm? The least thing that is necessary to be found in the object of worship is that the deity hears the calls of its worshippers and hastens to help him in his difficulties. Or there would be at least a kind of fear from opposition with its command. But these idols they were worshipping, they had nothing. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners' issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abu Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organised attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they call two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point, everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point, we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself. So we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are desecrating Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that. Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the subpoena was announced on what many say was likely the commission's last public hearing. The final report is expected shortly after the elections. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
The battered town of Obeznoi. I came here to find out if locals are fearful of the Ukrainian army, who have made recent gains not far to the west. A local school in the center of town.
Yes, we are worried. If the Ukrainian army comes here, there will be reprisal against teachers. But our strength is in the hope that it will never happen. I have colleagues whose children happen to be on the other side. They are afraid of coming to work because they are scared for their children and themselves.
Why do you think Ukraine would kill teachers? What's the reasoning behind that?
They say that we are ideological frontline workers and we are involved in Russian propaganda. This is the main thing that teachers are blamed for, but this region is 80% Russian speakers.
Irina, who's lived in this town all her life, tells me that she has heard rumors that teachers have been killed in Kapiansk, a town recently taken by Ukraine. This shocking video was posted online, claiming to be civilians in Kapiansk. It was uploaded by Maxim Zorin, a former member of Ukraine's notorious Azov Regiment, although he later altered his post, claiming the video had been taken from a Russian soldier's phone.
Now, to my knowledge, this is the only video that has surfaced in this war so far that clearly shows civilians being executed and dumped into a mass grave. Now, this video has been completely ignored by the mainstream media of NATO countries. Why? Because the evidence suggests a strong likelihood that these are Ukrainian soldiers executing pro-Russian civilians.
A headline from Britain's Daily Mail newspaper. The article quotes an advisor to Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A hunt has been declared on collaborators, and their life is not protected by law. Our intelligence services are eliminating them, shooting them like pigs. A humanitarian center. The Ukrainian government have not only threatened teachers, but those who distribute or receive humanitarian aid with jail.
We did nothing bad. We tried to help children and elderly people. What did we do? We were giving out aid under shelling. We helped people who couldn't walk. What shall we be afraid of? We just helped. I think there's nothing bad in it.
One of the volunteers asks us for a lift to help an old woman nearby.
What do you think of the Ukrainians threatening people who take humanitarian aid?
We heard of it. We even saw a video that in Kupiansk, some guys were taken into trenches and shot in the head. We have no internet, no proof. But they say there are nationalistic battalions that do it. It shouldn't be so. We are all people. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian.
While thousands of pro-Russians flee Ukrainian advances in fear, those that remain in areas taken over by Ukraine risk execution due to their political leanings. Indeed, most in Donbass expect a genocide or ethnic cleansing of Russian speakers if the Ukrainians were to ever reconquer the region. Johnny Milk, Rebeznoy, Donbass.
In order to verify the names of inmates on both sides, a Saudi technical delegation arrived in Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh, and the first stage of the swap deal clinched in Amman.
Sana'a always stresses the importance of humanitarian issues, and if there is a progress on humanitarian cases, it will lead to dialogue on political and military cases as well. There could be an extension of the terms and confidence building between the two parties. Sana'a welcomes any progress on humanitarian issues, encourages this visit, and asserts that its military warnings are serious, and moving toward peace is in the interest of Saudi Arabia.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the visits have nothing to do with any political talks. However, observers say this mutual visit is the first of its kind since the beginning of the war 7 years ago. Therefore, it is an indication of direct communication between Sana'a and Riyadh.
After nearly 8 years of war, siege, and the growing Yemeni military capabilities and the resilience of Yemenis, today the world realizes that Sana'a represents the Yemeni people. This is why we see international movements and international visits to Sana'a. The visit by the Saudi delegation is not the first of its kind, but there have been unannounced visits previously, and Sana'a welcomes peace endeavors.
Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashat, held talks with Assistant Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations, Joyce Missouya, in Sana'a. Al-Mashat urged the world body to reject all inhumane measures taken against the Yemeni people.
Following the failure to renew the UN brokered truce and the military parades of the Sana'a government, the international community is making new moves to find a more reliable agreement that satisfies both sides and ends the sufferings of millions of Yemenis. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
The olive harvest season has begun in the Gaza Strip, and farmers are picking olives on their land in order to provide for their families. Palestinian farmers and their families leave their everyday routines in the middle of October and dedicate some of their time to pick the fruits of nearly a year of hard work and special care. The olive harvest season runs until early November. The tiny coastal territory used to have a thriving olive industry, but it has suffered a major setback due to years of Israeli blockade and wars, as well as the systematic destruction of olive trees. The state of Gaza's olive farmers reflects the scope of human rights violations committed by the Israeli regime against thousands of Palestinian farmers. Israel's tight restrictions have been preventing farmers from acquiring badly needed equipment for irrigation and planting.
The situation is very difficult, especially for olive farmers. It takes many years to grow olive trees, and the Israeli blockade has made it extremely difficult for us to get fertilizers and badly needed farming equipment.
The annual olive harvest season is considered a key economic, social, and cultural event for Palestinians. Olive and agriculture in general have been hit hard by the Israeli blockade and war since 2007. Farmers here are struggling to keep this vital sector alive. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. His Holiness Muhammad and Prophet of Allah, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny has said, I leave among you the Thaghalain, the Book of Allah, and my Itra. Verily, they will be inseparable from each other until they join up with me at the pool of Kauthar. Selfish people and followers of Taghuts abuse the Holy Quran as a means by which to establish anti-Quranic rules. To achieve this mischievous target, they force off the scenes the true interpreters of the Quran, as well as those who have received all of the Holy Book directly from the Prophet, and their ears still echoed with the voice of His Holiness Muhammad, who declared, I leave among you the Thaghalain.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers. In one of his speeches, he said that sound prayers drive away obscenity and vice from an ummah. In this part of his speech, basically, he's referring to the verse of the Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ, that this prayer, if the sound prayers are offered, it drives away the obscenity and the vice, the fahsha, obscenity and the vice. Obviously, we know that when we pray, we are standing in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What he wants to say is, he says that these prayers, these sound prayers, it takes away, it drives away these two things from an ummah. And obviously, when we talk about the social life, we are talking about the Muslim ummah as a whole.
Generally, when we read this verse, we talk about the, or we have an idea about the individual life, that individually a person's life will not have these two things if he has sound prayers. But on the other hand, Imam Khomeini is mentioning another way, and he's pointing out something else, and he says that, no, it does not have an effect on the individual life as well as it has an effect on the society, on the ummah.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.